9. CEO Gladstone's schedule that morning was a busy one. Tau Ceti Center has a 23-hour day, which makes it convenient for the government to run on hegemony standard time without totally destroying local diurnal rhythms. At 0545 hours, Gladstone met with her military advisors. At 0630 hours, she breakfasted with 24 of the most important senators and with representatives of the All-Thing and the Techno-Corps. At 0715, the CEO forecast to Renaissance Vector, where it was evening, to officially open the Hermes Medical Center in Cadua. At 0740, she cast back to Government House for a meeting with her top aides, including Lee Hunt, to go over the speech she was to give to the Senate and All-Thing at 1000 hours. At 0830, Gladstone met again with General Morpurgo and Admiral Singh for an update on the situation in the Hyperion system. At 0845 hours, she met with me.
"Good morning, M. Severn," said the CEO. She was behind her desk in the office where I'd first met her 3 nights earlier. She waved her hand toward a buffet against the wall, where hot coffee, tea, and kafta sat in sterling silver pots. I shook my head and sat down. 3 of the holographic windows showed white light, but the one to my left offered the 3D map of Hyperion system that I had tried to decode in the war room. It seemed to me that Ouster Red now covered and infiltrated the system, like dye dissolving and settling into a blue solution.
"I want to hear your dreams," said CEO Gladstone. "I want to hear why you abandoned them," I said, voice flat. "Why you left Father Hoyt to die." Gladstone could not have been used to being spoken to in that tone, not after 48 years in the Senate and a decade and a half as CEO. But her only reaction was to raise one eyebrow a fraction of an inch.
"So you do dream the real events. Did you doubt it?"
She set down the work pad she had been holding, keyed it off, and shook her head.
"Not really, but it is still a shock to hear about something that no one else in the web knows about. Why did you deny them the use of the consul's ship?"
Gladstone swiveled to look up at the window where the tactical display shifted and changed as new updates changed the flow of red, the retreat of blue, the movement of planets and moons. But if the military situation was to have been part of her explanation, she abandoned that approach. She swiveled back.
"Why would I have to explain any executive decision to you, M. Severn? What is your constituency? Whom do you represent?"
"I represent those 5 people and a baby you left stranded on Hyperion," I said. "Hoyt could have been saved." Gladstone made a fist and tapped her lower lip with a curved forefinger.
"Perhaps," she said. "And perhaps he was already dead. But that wasn't the issue, was it?"
I sat back in the chair. I had not bothered to bring a sketchbook along, and my fingers ached to hold something.
"What is, then?" "Do you remember Father Hoyt's story? The story he told during their voyage to the tombs?" asked Gladstone.
"Yes. Each of the pilgrims is allowed to petition the Shrike for one favor. Tradition says that the creature grants one wish while denying the others and murdering those he denies. Do you remember what Hoyt's wish was?"
I paused. Recalling incidents from the pilgrim's past was like trying to remember details of last week's dreams.
"He wanted the cruciforms removed," I said. "He wanted freedom for both Father DeRay's soul, DNA, whatever, and for himself."
"Not quite," said Gladstone. "Father Hoyt wanted to die."
I stood up, almost knocking my chair over, and strode to the pulsing map.
"That's pure bullshit," I said. "Even if he did, the others had an obligation to save him, and so did you. You let him die."
"Yes. Just as you're going to let the rest of them die?"
"Not necessarily," said CEO Mayna Gladstone. "That is their will, and the Shrike's, if such a creature actually exists. All I know at this point is that their pilgrimage is too important to allow them a means of retreat at the moment of decision."
"Whose decision? Theirs? How can the lives of 6 or 7 people and a baby affect the outcome of a society of 150 billion? I knew the answer to that, of course. The AI Advisory Council, as well as the hegemony's less sentient predictors, had chosen the pilgrims very carefully. But for what? Unpredictability. They were ciphers that matched the ultimate enigma of the entire Hyperion equation. Did Gladstone know that? Or did she know only what Counselor Albedo and her own spies told her? I sighed and returned to my chair.
"Did your dream tell you what the fate of Colonel Cassad was?" asked the CEO.
"No. I awoke before they returned to the Sphinx to seek shelter from the storm." Gladstone smiled slightly.
"You realize, M. Severn, that for our purposes it would be more convenient to have you sedated, prompted by the same truth-talk your Philomel friends used, and connected to sub-vocalizers, for a more constant report on the events on Hyperion."
I returned her smile. "Yes," I said, "that would be more convenient, but it would be less than convenient for you if I slipped away into the core via the datasphere and left my body behind, which is precisely what I will do if put under duress again."
"Of course," said Gladstone. "That is precisely what I would do if put in such circumstances. Tell me, M. Severn, what is it like in the core? What is it like in that distant place where your consciousness truly resides?"
"Busy," I said. "Did you want to see me for anything else today?" Gladstone smiled again, and I sensed that it was a true smile, not the politician's weapon she used so well.
"Yes," she said, "I did have something else in mind. Would you like to go to Hyperion? The real Hyperion?"
"The real Hyperion?" I echoed stupidly. I felt my fingers and toes tingle, as a strange sense of excitement suffused me. My consciousness might truly reside in the core, but my body and brain were all too human, all too susceptible to adrenaline and other random chemicals. Gladstone nodded.
"Millions of people want to go there. Farcast of somewhere new. Watch the war from up close."
She sighed and moved her work pad.
"The idiots."
She looked up at me, and her brown eyes were serious.
"But I want someone to go there and report back to me in person. Leah's using one of the new military Farcast terminals this morning, and I thought that you might join him. There might not be time to set down on Hyperion itself, but you would be in system." I thought of several questions, and was embarrassed by the first one that emerged.
"Will it be dangerous?" Neither Gladstone's expression nor tone changed.
"Possibly. Although you will be far behind the lines, and Lee has explicit instructions not to expose himself or you to any obvious risk."
Obvious risk, I thought. But how many less than obvious risks were there in a war zone, near a world where a creature like the Shrike roamed free?
"Yes," I said. "I'll go. But there's one thing."
"Yes?"
"I need to know why you want me to go. It seems that if you just want me for my connection to the pilgrims, you're running a needless risk in sending me away."
Gladstone nodded.
"M. Severn, it's true that your connection to the pilgrims, although somewhat tenuous, is of interest to me. But it is also true that I am interested in your observations and evaluations. Your observations."
"But I'm nothing to you," I said.
"You don't know who else I might be reporting to, deliberately or otherwise. I'm a creature of the Technocore."
"Yes," said Gladstone.
"But you also may be the least affiliated person on Tau Ceti Center at this moment, perhaps in the entire web. Also, your observations are those of a trained poet, a man whose genius I respect."
I barked a laugh.
"He was a genius," I said. "I'm a simulacrum, a drone, a caricature."
"Are you so sure?" asked Mayna Gladstone.
I held up empty hands. "I haven't written a line of poetry in the 10 months I have been alive and aware in this strange afterlife," I said. "I do not think in poetry. Isn't that proof enough that this core retrieval project is a sham?"
Even my false name is an insult to a man infinitely more talented than I will ever be. Joseph Severn was a shade in comparison to the real Keats, but I sully his name by using it.
That may be true, said Gladstone, and it may not. In either case, I've requested that you go with M. Hunt on this brief trip to Hyperion. She paused. You have no duty to go. In more than one sense, you are not even a citizen of the hegemony. But I would appreciate it if you did go.
I'll go, I said again, hearing my own voice as if from a distance.
Very good. You'll need warm clothes. Wear nothing that would come loose or cause embarrassment in free fall, although there is little likelihood that you will encounter that. Meet M. Hunt in the primary government house Farcaster Nexus in... She glanced at her comm log. 12 minutes. I nodded and turned to go. Oh, M. Severn. I paused by the door. The old woman behind the desk suddenly looked rather small and very tired.
Thank you, M. Severn, she said.
It was true that millions wanted to forecast to the war zone. The All Thing was shrill with petitions, arguments for letting citizens cast to Hyperion, requests by cruise lines to run brief excursions, and demands by planetary politicians and hegemony representatives to be allowed to tour the system on fact-finding missions. All such requests had been denied. Web citizens, especially web citizens with power and influence, were not used to being denied access to new experiences, and for the hegemony, all-out war remained one of the few experiences still untried. But the CEO's office and the force authorities remained adamant. No civilian or unauthorized forecasting to the Hyperion system. No uncensored news steep coverage. In an age where no information was inaccessible, no travel denied, such exclusion was maddening and tantalizing. I met M. Hunt at the executive Farcaster Nexus after showing my authorization pip to an even dozen security nodes. Hunt was wearing black wool, undecorated, but evocative of the force uniforms present everywhere in this section of Government House. I had had little time to change, returning to my apartments only to grab a loose vest with many pockets to hold drawing materials and a 35mm imager.
Ready? Said Hunt.
The Basset Hound face did not look pleased to see me. He carried a plain black valise. I nodded. Hunt gestured toward a force transport technician, and a one-time portal shimmered into existence. I knew that the thing was tuned to our DNA signatures and would admit no one else. Hunt took a breath and stepped through. I watched the quicksilver portal surface ripple after his passage, like a stream returning to calm after the slightest of breezes. And then I stepped through myself. It was rumored that the original Farcaster prototypes had offered no sensation during transition, and that the AI and human designers had altered the machinery to add that vague, prickling, ozone-charged feeling, to give the traveler a sense of having traveled. Whatever the truth of that, my skin was still alive with tension as I took a step away from the portal, paused, and looked around. It's strange but true that war-going spacecraft have been depicted in fiction, film, holo, and stim-sim for more than 800 years. Even before humankind had left old Earth in anything but atmosphere-skimming converted airplanes, their flat films had shown epic space battles, huge interstellar dreadnoughts with incredible armament lunging through space like streamlined cities. Even the spate of recent war hollies, after the Battle of Brescia, showed great fleets battling it out at distances two ground soldiers would find claustrophobic. Ships ramming and firing and burning, like Greek triremes packed into the Straits of Artemisium. It's little wonder, then, that my heart was pounding and my palms were a bit moist as I stepped onto the flagship of the fleet, expecting to emerge onto the broad bridge of a warship out of the hollies. Giant screens showing enemy ships, klaxon sounding, craggy commanders huddled over the technical command panels as the ship lurched first right, then left. Hunt and I were standing in what could have been a narrow corridor of a power plant.
Color-coded pipes twisted everywhere. Occasional handholds and airtight hatches at regular intervals suggested that we were indeed in a spacecraft. State-of-the-art disky and interact panels showed that the corridor served some purpose other than access to elsewhere. But the overall effect was one of claustrophobia and primitive technology. I half expected to see wires running from circuit nodes. A vertical shaft intersected our corridor. Other narrow, cluttered avenues were visible through other hatches. Hunt looked at me and shrugged slightly. I wondered if it was possible that we had forecast to the wrong destination. Before either of us said anything, a young Force space ensign in black battle dress appeared from one of the side corridors, saluted Hunt, and said, "Welcome to the HS Hebrides, gentlemen. Admiral Nishita had asked me to convey his compliments and to invite you to the Combat Control Center. If you will follow me, please." With that, the young ensign wheeled, reached for a rung, and pulled himself into a cramped vertical shaft. We followed as best we could, Hunt struggling not to drop his valise, and me trying not to have my hands ground under Hunt's heels as we climbed. After only a few yards, I realized that the gravity was far less than one standard here, was not, in fact, gravity at all, but felt more like a multitude of small but insistent hands pressing me down. I knew about spacecraft using a Class 1 containment field throughout a ship to simulate gravity, but this was my first direct experience of it. It was not a truly pleasant sensation. The constant pressure was rather like leaning into a wind, and the effect added to the claustrophobic qualities of the narrow corridors, small hatches, and equipment-cluttered bulkheads. The Hebrides was a 3C ship, Communication Control Command, and the Combat Control Center was its heart and brain. But it was not a very impressive heart and brain. The young ensign passed us through three airtight hatches, led us down a final corridor past Marine guards, saluted, and left us in a room perhaps 20 yards square, but one so crowded with noise, personnel, and equipment that one's first instinct was to step back outside the hatch to get a breath of air. There were no giant screens, but dozens of young Force space officers hunkered over cryptic displays, sat enmeshed in StimSim apparatus, or stood before pulsing call-ups which seemed to extend from all six bulkheads. Men and women were lashed into their chairs and sensory cradles, with the exception of a few officers, most looking more like harried bureaucrats than craggy warriors, who wandered the narrow aisles, patting subordinates on the back, barking for more information and plugging into consoles with their own implant jacks. One of these men came over in a hurry, looked at us both, saluted me, and said, "M. Hunt?" I nodded toward my companion. "M. Hunt," said the overweight young commander. "Admiral Nishita will see you now." The commander of all hegemony forces in the Hyperion system was a small man with short white hair, skin far smoother than his age suggested, and a fierce scowl that seemed carved in place. Admiral Nishita wore high-necked dress black with no rank insignia except for the single red dwarf sun on his collar. His hands were blunt and quite powerful-looking, but the nails were recently manicured. The admiral sat on a small dais, surrounded by equipment and quiescent call-ups. The bustle and efficient madness seemed to flow around him like a fast stream around an impervious rock. "You're the messenger from Gladstone," he said to Hunt. "Who's this?"
"My aide," said Lee Hunt.
I resisted the urge to raise an eyebrow.
"What do you want?" asked Nishita. "As you see, we're busy."
Lee Hunt nodded and glanced around.
"I have some materials for you, Admiral. Is there any place we can go for privacy?"
Admiral Nishita grunted, passed his palm over a rheosense, and the air behind me grew denser, coalescing into a semi-solid mist as the containment field reified. The noise of the combat control center disappeared. The three of us were in a small igloo of quiet.
"Hurry it up," said Admiral Nishita.
Hunt unlocked the valise and removed a small envelope with a Government House symbol on the back.
"A private communication from the chief executive," said Hunt. "To be read at your leisure, Admiral."
Nishita grunted and set the envelope aside.
Hunt set a larger envelope on the desk. And this is a hard copy of the motion of the Senate regarding the prosecution of this, military action. As you know, the will of the Senate is for this to be a speedy exercise of force to achieve limited objectives, with as little loss of life as possible, followed by the standard offer of help and protection to our new colonial asset. Nishita's scowl twitched slightly. He made no move to touch or read the communication containing the will of the Senate.
Is that all?
Hunt took his time responding. That is all. Unless you wish to relay a personal message to the CEO through me, Admiral. Nishita stared. There was no active hostility in his small black eyes, only an impatience that I guessed would not be quenched until those eyes were dimmed by death.
I have private fatline access to the chief executive, said the Admiral. Thank you very much, M. Hunt. No return messages at this time. Now, if you will kindly return to the midship's forecaster nexus, and let me get on with prosecuting this military action.
The containment field collapsed around us, and noise flowed in like water over a melting ice dam. There is one other thing, said Lee Hunt, his soft voice almost lost under the techno-babble of the combat center. Admiral Nishita swiveled his chair and waited. We'd like to transport down to the planet, said Hunt. Down to Hyperion. The Admiral's scowl seemed to deepen.
CEO Gladstone's people said nothing about arranging a dropship.
Hunt did not blink. Governor General Lane knows that we might be coming. Nishita glanced at one of his call-ups, snapped his fingers, and barked something at a Marine major who hurried over.
You'll have to hurry, the Admiral said to Hunt. There is a courier just ready to leave from Port 20. Major Inverness will show you the way. You will be brought back up to the primary jump ship. The Hebrides will be departing this position in 23 minutes.
Hunt nodded and turned to follow the Major. I tagged along. The Admiral's voice stopped us.
M. Hunt, he called. Please tell CEO Gladstone that the flagship will be too busy from this point on for any more political visits.
Nishita turned away to flickering call-ups and a line of waiting subordinates. I followed Hunt and the Major back into the maze.
There should be windows.
What? I had been thinking about something, not paying attention. Lee Hunt turned his head toward me.
I've never been in a dropship without windows or view screens. It's strange.
I nodded and looked around, noticing the cramped and crowded interior for the first time. It was true that there were only blank bulkheads and heaps of supplies and one young lieutenant in the passenger hold of the dropship with us. It seemed to conform to the claustrophobic ambience of the command ship. I looked away, returning to the thoughts that had preoccupied me since we left Nishita. Following the other two to Port 20, it had suddenly occurred to me that I was not missing something I had expected to miss. Part of my anxiety toward this trip had lain in the thought of leaving the datasphere. I was rather like a fish contemplating leaving the sea. Part of my consciousness lay submerged somewhere in that sea. The ocean of data and comm links from 200 worlds and the core, all linked by the invisible medium once called Datum Plane, now known only as the Megasphere. It struck me as we left Nishita that I could still hear the pulse of that particular sea. Distant but constant, like the sound of the surf half a mile from the shore, and I had been trying to understand it all during the rush to the dropship, the buckling in and separation, and the 10-minute cislunar sprint to the fringes of Hyperion's atmosphere. Force prided itself on using its own artificial intelligences, its own dataspheres and computing sources. The ostensible reason lay in the requirement to operate in the great spaces between web worlds, the dark and quiet places between the stars and beyond the web megasphere. But much of the real reason lay in a fierce need for independence, which Force had shown toward the Technocore for centuries. Yet on a Force ship in the center of a Force armada in a non-web, non-protectorate system, I was tuned to the same comforting background babble of data and energy that I would have found anywhere in the web. Interesting. I thought of the links the Farcaster had brought to Hyperion System. Not just the jump ship and Farcaster containment sphere, floating at Hyperion's L3 point like a gleaming new moon, but the miles of giga-channel fiber-optic cable, snaking through permanent jump ship Farcaster portals, microwave repeaters mechanically shuttling the few inches to repeat their messages in near real time, command ship tame AIs requesting and receiving new links to the Olympus High Command on Mars and elsewhere. Somewhere, the datasphere had crept in, perhaps unknown to the Force machines and their operators and allies. The core AIs knew everything happening here in Hyperion System. If my body were to die now, I would have the same escape path as always, fleeing down the pulsing links that led like secret passages beyond the web, beyond any vestige of datum plane as humanity had known it, down data link tunnels to the techno core itself. Not really to the core, I thought, because the core surrounds, envelops the rest, like an ocean holding separate currents, great gulf streams which think themselves separate seas.
I just wish there was a window, whispered Leigh Hunt.
Yes, I said. So do I. The dropship bucked and vibrated as we entered Hyperion's upper atmosphere. Hyperion, I thought. The Shrike. My heavy shirt and vest seemed sticky and clinging. A faint susurration from without said that we were flying, streaking across the lapis skies at several times the speed of sound. The young lieutenant leaned across the aisle.
First time down, gentlemen?
Hunt nodded. The lieutenant was chewing gum, showing how relaxed he was.
You two civilian techs from the Hebrides?
We just came from there, yes, said Hunt.
Thought so, grinned the lieutenant. Me, I'm running a courier pack down to the Marine base near Keats, my fifth trip.
A slight jolt ran through me as I was reminded of the name of the capital. Hyperion had been repopulated by Sad King Billy and his colony of poets, artists, and other misfits fleeing an invasion of their home world by Horace Glennon Height, an invasion which never came. The poet on the current Shrike pilgrimage, Martin Silenus, had advised King Billy almost 2 centuries earlier in the naming of the capital. Keats. The locals called the old part Jacktown.
You're not going to believe this place, said the lieutenant. It's the real anal end of nowhere. I mean, no datasphere, no EMVs, no Farcasters, no stim-sim bars, no nothing. It's no wonder that there are thousands of the fucking indigenes camped around the spaceport, just tearing down the fence to get off-world.
Are they really attacking the spaceport? Asked Hunt.
Nah, said the lieutenant, and snapped his gum. But they're ready to, if you know what I mean. That's why the 2nd Marine Battalion has set up a perimeter there and secured the way into the city. Besides, the yokels think that we're going to set up Farcasters any day now and let them step out of the shit they got themselves into.
They got themselves into? I said.
The lieutenant shrugged. They must have done something to get the ousters cricked at them, right? We're just here to pull their oysters out of the fire.
Chestnuts, said Leigh Hunt.
The gum snapped.
Whatever.
The susurration of wind grew to a shriek, clearly audible through the hull. The dropship bounced twice and then slid smoothly, ominously smoothly, as if it had encountered a chute of ice 10 miles above the ground.
I wish we had a window, whispered Leigh Hunt.
It was warm and stuffy in the dropship. The bouncing was oddly relaxing, rather like a small sailing ship rising and falling on slow swells. I closed my eyes for a few minutes.